Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Andrew on the board. We have Mr. Kevin.
Yes, you do.
We have S&P's up 31, NASDAQ futures up 163. So the full sell-off yesterday is another example of buy the dip. So there you go. We continue to do that. We continue to educate people there. Just hope maybe one day it won't happen. We'll see, but maybe it'll continue to happen every day. We were down 400 points in the NASDAQ yesterday. Futures finished down 80, and now we're up. So we're actually up from probably yesterday, from the start of the week, which is really... But now Google avoids a harsh antitrust penalty. Well, of course they do. You know, they went to the White House, and we don't do any antitrust here. You only got to worry, you know, antitrust penalties you worry about are over in Europe. It's pretty amazing. As they say, Kevin, we don't know where we're going, but we're well on our way, and we're almost there, huh? Yeah.
We don't know where we're going, but we're getting there fast.
Yep. It's kind of an interesting thing that we're seeing. I don't know where it's... I'm sure that when the 30-year rate made it to 5% yesterday, or right near it, that the Fed immediately started pouring money in. So that game is still there. We'll see. We'll see where it all lands. I was reading this article this morning. He sent me, Kevin, about the St. Louis Cardinals ticket sales. And, we've been kind of a... Actually, with all the guests, we've been sort of a little bit of an ongoing theme of what different people, different groups, different businesses, depending on how essentially their life is going, what their view of the world is. I was telling you about one of my buddies who has he splits the season tickets at the Cubs. And I think the Cubs' view of the world is, they still have a waiting list, I think. At least they claim they do, for their stuff. And their view of the world right now is, let's put on the gas full speed ahead. And there isn't any amount of money they can charge in their mind, be it beers, hot dogs, parking, you name it, that can dissuade, the rabid fan. And we've seen in some cases when all of a sudden the rabid fan finds out he doesn't have to do that. I mean, I think the most amazing case, Kevin, had to be the Hawks from the old stadium to the new place. One of the hardest tickets to get in all sports was to get a ticket to the Blackhawk game. And what did the old place seat, Kevin, 19, 18, something like that?
19, and they went to, 24?
Something like that. But it was the 19 included standing room, which we did a lot. It was right about there. And but just at the same time, the team kind of started to suck, and all of a sudden... That's part of it, but sometimes the old team sucked too. But all of a sudden, you could get a ticket. I don't need to get standing room. I don't need to get tickets in advance. I can just go to a game. And I think they dropped down to like 7, didn't they, or 9 from 19 before they started to get better again.
Yeah, and so a lot of it is team performance. There is a good question because when the Blackhawks had that run where they won the Stanley Cup 3 times, it was a hot ticket again. So there's always people who are gonna jump on the bandwagon. But you have to wonder if the hockey audience isn't as broad as, say, the baseball or football audience, and you have to wonder if they were right the threshold for genuine interest in tickets to Blackhawks games was somewhere between the capacity of the old stadium and the new one. And maybe they hit that and stopped selling out as well. So that's kind of an interesting way to think about it, but no way to prove it. The article about the Cardinals is a little bit different. And one of the things the article asserted was that, you know, there's probably about a 2-year lag. So they're hitting that 2-year lag now. The Cardinals have not been good. This is the third year in a row of not being good. If you look at the Cubs when they're not good, the Chicago metropolitan area is still big enough that you're going to get a lot of attendance. But even with the Cubs, if you look at, 2021 was an oddball year anyway, but they only drew 1.9 million. And despite not being good, they went to 2.6 million, 2.7 million, 2.9 million. And right now they're at 2.546 million with a month to go. So, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, how they've done. They've been a somewhat better team the last 2 years before this year, apparently being a playoff team. The 2 years before that, they won 83 and lost 79. So, you know, they were okay. You know, they weren't great, but they were okay. If you look at the Cardinals' record over those same 3 years, they were 71 and 91, then they were 83 and 79, which was sort of an improvement, but now they're at 69 and 71. And the metro area there just isn't so big that someone's going to fill in the blanks when a ticket's available. It's just not going to happen there.
See, so, I think it's not, somehow or another, it's sort of not based on the team necessarily being good. I mean, I can't say that. I'm not saying you're wrong on that. You're certainly not. There's a mix to that, Kevin, and I don't know what the mix is. There's some teams, it's the place to be. You know, when we did the 305 games on a Friday night when I was young on the trading floor, it didn't matter if it was the Mud Hens playing somebody else. It was the place to be.
Yeah, you duck out of work a little bit early, yeah. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I've been to games at the current, at the current stadium that they have. There isn't a whole lot to do around there on a game day. It's right downtown, but for instance, on a Saturday,
you're talking about the real Mud Hens. I was just thinking up a name.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the Cardinals.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what else attracts anybody if it's not the baseball game, whereas the Cubs have actually done, for their own purposes anyway, we can argue the merits of some of the things that they've done for the neighborhood or haven't done for the neighborhood, but they have made the Wrigley Field area a significant entertainment district. A lot of that was underway before the Ricketts bought it. You know, places like the Metro were there with a lot of really good concerts, but they've built out the Gallagher Way. I think they bought up a lot of the properties around the neighborhood. There's a lot that says going to a Cubs game can be a all-day experience. It can be a family experience. It can be an adult's, type of experience to catch a Cubs game and then go to dinner in the area or do something like that. So there's probably some positive influence there on attendance that you can make it a game day experience. But I don't think that exists in St. Louis. I'm willing to be corrected on that, but that wasn't my observation when I was there. But I really think it's tied solely in St. Louis to the performance of the team.
See, I don't.
The winning there that they don't like having a bad team.
I'm gonna go 50-50 with you on that, because somehow or another, Kevin, and things change, and a lot of it has to do with price. I started to say earlier that my my buddy, who has shares the Cubs season tickets, well, he just got, now, if the Cubs get the number one wild card spot, which it looks like they might, barring either doing great or doing crummy, they get to host a three-game series at home. So he just got the bill for his quarter of his, for his, well, they split four seats, so say for one seat, they want $1,650, like right now, for playoff tickets. I don't think he has $1,650 to send him, or really doesn't want to. Now, you could in today's world, and of course, if they don't make it, they don't send it to you back. They apply it to the ticket next year. All right, now, in today's world, you guys, you high-tech dudes, you know that it would be very possible to charge you per game if there actually was going to be a game. I wouldn't like that kind of high-tech, but the same bleeps that won't give me a ticket because they have to have everything electronic, those same guys, if they wanted to, could charge me per game. But they don't want to. They want all the money up front. I mean, the technology is terrific if it helps you, but not so much if it doesn't, right? But, I mean, this is, I guess what my theme is, what is their view? And if for somebody who had, I keep saying I had season tickets. I didn't. I split a season ticket package with my buddy Big Don. They were actually Don's seats. The whole story was we had 305 seats. He had weekend and holiday seats. And when they decided neither one of those were going to be anymore because they were going to have the upper deck open all the time, it's way back in the early 80s, he had to either say no or he had to get the full season. So the two of us split the season. And I, you know, business was good. I was making a lot of money on the trading floor in those days. Honestly, Kevin, if I went to 20 games out of my 40, it was fine. I didn't care really if I gave the other, I mean, people came and bought the tickets from me. I never charged over face. And if somebody really wanted them, they could have them. The thing that buried me was I couldn't give them away. A few years during the rebuilding, all of a sudden, there was some interest up until June, and then there was none. These corporations, they may be dumb, they may be slow, but they're not idiots. The reason why the St. Louis season ticket thing is dropping is because every company doesn't have to have them. There's not the demand. There isn't somebody when the Bulls were really good, when Mesro had the Bulls skybox, for God's sake, it was somebody's job to dish out the skybox seats to every salesperson or every broker, and they only brought their best customers, and you had to sign up for them, and it had to be your people, and you better not be bringing your nephew. It better be a customer who really wants to go or somebody who's going to be a customer. It's a big deal for that amount of money. And just because corporations, you know, have money doesn't mean they like to piss it away. If all of a sudden you call up 10 of your biggest clients and say, hey, I got skybox for the White Sox, and they go, so what? I don't want to go. That thing drops like a rock. It just does. I mean, you remember when they built the stadium? How long have the Nationals been around? Is it 20 years now? Something like that.
When did they move there? I'm not sure.
I'm gonna say 15 to 20. I could be wrong. Andrew, why don't you look that up? See when the Washington Nationals became Washington? They moved from Montreal, right?
Yes.
And I won't say there were fist fights, Kevin, but there almost were. Every lobbyist firm, every law firm was fighting over those skyboxes, was fighting over the best seats. It was if you didn't have the best, the good tickets there, and you were a lobbyist or a law firm or something, you were the part that went over the fence last. And I went to a game there in their second year, and I sat just outside where all the really good seats were. It was just the other side of the dugout. I'll say that
I'll save you the lookup. It was 2005 when they became the Washington.
20 years. How about that? We were pretty close, eh?
Yep.
Let's just say the two-legged scenery, something I've never seen, Kevin, ever, ever, ever. You could have gone to a beauty pageant and it wouldn't look like that. Every good-looking girl in Washington was at that game courtesy of some skyboxers, whatever. Now, the last time this year the Cubs played out there, the place is empty. It's because it's not to happen in place somehow. It's not the meeting place. It's not somehow. And once you fall out of that, the corporations go, if I can't, I'll bet out there the lobbyists still keep them, because in case they have somebody out there, or in case they ever get better, you have to have them. But I'll bet it's less and less people. And once you start doing that, you know, in St. Louis, I bet there's people, I can only use the Skybox 30 times last year, and it's, you know, PTI Securities, and you're, you know, Kevin O'Neill Consulting, and you go, how about if I dump mine and we just split yours? I'm sure there's a lot of that going on, right?
Yeah, I am sure there is. It's interesting. I'd like to give credit to the article.
Oh, he did a nice job, didn't he?
Because he did a good job. But it's on a website called Viva Alberto's, and the guy's, you know, using a handle for his instead of his full name. But he said that there's some research, and it came down to six factors that go into ticket sales. The first one being price sensitivity. The consumers are responsive to price, with discounts being a top deciding factor in the purchase. So if there are, you know, it's like the White Sox. I don't know if they still do it, but they used to have a half price Mondays for the bleachers. The Brewers probably still have like a five county a night for the five counties that get discounted tickets, because those are the counties that funded the stadium. So you know, there's probably some price sensitivity, or at least people are going to pounce on the good deals when they can get them.
Kevin, you're old enough to remember Ladies Day.
Yeah, I do remember Ladies Day. Yes. Accessibility, the ease of purchasing tickets, so you know, how easy is it to get your hands on them? Purchase timing of purchases can influence the likelihood of a sale, and that, you know, for single game tickets, that was always something for me, especially when I lived in Milwaukee or in the Milwaukee area, and it was really, really easy to decide I'm going to the game. I'll go online right now. Let me see if some good seats are available. Buy them, and you know, I could go to the game that night, because the you know, because it was just, I knew it was going to be a good night. I knew I was going to see some good baseball. Perceived value is, this is the interesting one, the perceived value of the ticket compared to the price, and that one I think has a lot to do with how good the team is. They have the event lineup, so the lineup of events can influence the decision. I don't know how much that does. Do people, that would be an interesting question, and I don't know a lot of people that go, because today is PCA bobblehead night or anything like that. I think that's just something
I've never gone early enough to get one of those, so I wouldn't even be able to tell you.
And then social factors, so the actions of, and attitudes of others, friends and family, can sway both the purchase and the attendance decision. I think the social factors is what you mentioned earlier. Is it the place to be?
At the risk of Andrew getting 58 emails saying what a Luddite I am, I think that the difficulty in transferring tickets is still a problem as well. I can't just, somebody walks up 10 minutes before the game.
I would say that it can be a problem, especially when you have people who would love to just walk over to you and hand you a pair of tickets, because they're the company tickets, and say, do you want to go? We have some space available. Do you want to go? By the same token, the ability to transfer tickets online can be a real boon, because if I can't go, for instance, I'm a Notre Dame basketball season ticket holder. If I can't go to tomorrow's game, and I call up a friend and say, you want to go? And the answer is yes. I say, I'll transfer you the tickets. Just accept it, and you'll have. I would have to get him the paper ticket.
Well, that part would be a convenience. Now, if I sell you my tickets, do we have to give them a cut?
No, the money transfer is an entirely different thing.
I mean, I suppose if you knew each other well enough, you could send me the ticket, and I could Zembo you, wherever stuff is, the money, which I don't do. But
it sort of depends on where you go too, and how you do the transfer. I'm talking about a transfer on Notre Dame's website. So, you know,
do they get a piece of that?
I have a season ticket holder account with Notre Dame, and so I can just transfer those tickets to anybody I want. But there is no provision for the financial settlement on that. If that were the case, you might be doing that through Ticketmaster or somebody.
Yeah, I think you have to do that. Go through Ticketmaster, right, or somebody.
I don't have to with my Notre Dame tickets.
Well, I know when I decided to go to the one, my buddy from forever's 80th birthday of all things, was at Sox thing. Now that was a real pain in the ass because those tickets came right from the Sox, so that's a different app than if a Sox season ticket holder. The transfer from the season ticket holder is through, I'm going to say StubHub or somebody like that, where the one from the Sox is from something else.
Yeah, see, StubHub is just a secondary market for selling. So I can, if I have a StubHub account, I can list my tickets on there, and then sell them, and that would be a StubHub transfer rather than, and Notre Dame would be out of it.
But then they get a piece.
Not necessarily.
I think when Larry had his last year, he had his Sox season ticket.
They have an arrangement, and I think theirs is with StubHub, that they dump some of their overflow onto there, and I'm not entirely, but even then, the phenomenon I've seen there, Tom, is, and here's how it works, is a game will be getting close to a sellout. So, you know, like a big basketball game, Notre Dame women against UConn, which is typically a sold out game or near a sellout. But you'll see some of those games, some of their bigger games will show up as, you know, oh, there's 2,000 tickets left or 1,500 tickets left or something like that. And then miraculously, a day before the game, it's a sellout, but there's lots of tickets available on StubHub. And what typically happens there is the school will take its inventory on that last day, and they will say, "Here, StubHub, these aren't sold. You buy them from me as a discount, or at a discount. So if it's, I don't know, $20 for a seat, then you can buy them for $5. And then you sell as many of them as you can for whatever you can get for them. Then you go to the game that they told you was a sellout, and you'll see that in a 9,000 seat arena, there's about 1,000 seats still left. So what do they do? If there's 2,000, if they buy 2,000 at five bucks each, they spend what, 10,000?
Well,
and then they may sell a half of those for $20, for the list price of $20, and so StubHub makes money, but Notre Dame got paid for tickets that they weren't going to sell.
Well, the first year, and this all has changed because Larry hasn't had his tickets for a while. My assistant money manager's here. Larry's had season tickets of Sox forever. The last year when they started doing all this stuff, I think he told me that he had to go through the Sox. This is, you know, it's probably 8 years ago, but you had to go through the Sox site. You could not list a seat for less than face because the Sox were still trying to sell them at face. So, and then they took a fee. So you essentially had to offer the seat on a game you didn't want, and maybe nobody wanted, at like 20% higher than the ticket price, just to break even. At the same time, the Sox are selling them at the ticket price. So it made it, it probably was the single biggest reason why he dumped his season tickets. You know, that was even before the Sox sucked. Probably wasn't that long after the World Series, but I'm going to say...
On the other hand, Tom, you can dissociate yourself from the White Sox. You aren't beholden to them or the service that they use.
I'm talking year one when they did this.
I understand, yeah. But you can independently have your own buyer and seller account on a StubHub or Vivid Seats or somebody like that. You can independently do that, because you will go see games listed and they'll tell you that the price is...
I'm with you. What I'm trying to describe is...
$2 for
Well, you're doing a nice job at describing today's world. I'm saying the first year or two, it was so clumsy that it made it almost impossible for somebody to... You had to go through them. I'm talking like the first year they did this. You had to go through them. They took a fee, and you couldn't list them for under... I mean, obviously, StubHub, you can list them wherever you want, I think. But the Sox wouldn't let you... This maybe was before they let StubHub in, is what I'm saying, the first year or two. So it was a while ago. But it was enough to lose his season tickets, you know, so all these little... I think the lesson here is just because you're big and you're a monopoly, just because it's more convenient for you doesn't mean it's more convenient for your customer, right? And the idea is, you know, the Cubs, the attitude, because they got Wrigley Field and, you know, it's the only probably walk-up crowd left in the world, damn near. They feel that they are, you know, absolutely insulated by anything like this. Want to make the beer $18? You know, so why, you know, it's funny, Ken, we got a break here, but you can look at things, and I'm going to say the new theme of the show is probably the everything is on the three chessboards, right? I don't know if I ever tell you this story. Somewhere along the line, after the 2008 fiasco, and the markets are flying down, and Bear Stearns was at $30 on what, Thursday morning, and they'd come down from like 100. You know, this is fuzzy, distant past, so don't take my numbers to the bank. Of course, there is no Bear Stearns anymore. You can't do that. And Pete Najarian was on TV, and they said something about, and they're buying all these puts. You know, like the 10 puts for like the Friday, and this was like a Thursday morning. You know, and Pete was talking about how many people were buying those puts, and somewhere on either on the radio or I wrote a column or something, and I said, no way on earth is somebody buying the 10 puts on a stock on a Thursday that's trading 35 without having some sort of inside information. And nobody would ever even dream of that. That you know, unless something was in. Not in the news, or there was some rumor out there, or the Fed leaked something, or whatever the hell it was. And it got picked up by Notre Dame. The lady used to work for us, Sarah, was an internet maven. And she would, you know, she would, once in a while, not every day, she just, you know, drop a search on there for my name. And sure enough, it popped out as a Notre Dame, what do you want to call it, some website over there, that this guy had used my quote as one of his exam questions in terms of, you know, that there had to be something wrong with this. And he used it as a question regarding the, you know, the free flow of information and stocks and bonds and those kinds of things, and how it was, in my opinion, so obvious that something was amiss, and some people knew about it and some people didn't. And he used that as a basis for a final exam question. So I write the guy a note, and I say, hey, I'm coming down for whatever reunion it was. I said, how about getting together for a beer? And he goes, oh, sure. You know, so I meet the guy, and he looks just like a professor, right? And we're sitting there, and we're BSing, and I said, you know, this is how different levels you are. And he was the guy who started telling me about how much they made on these, what do you call them, satellite class places? They used to have,
a program in Chicago?
Yeah, there was one, at least one here, because Audrey's friend Kathy, her sister, went to one of them. I think there was, for those that don't know what we're talking about, now when Kevin does a class, he can do Zoom class for people and you can get at your house. It wasn't always like that. If you wanted to be in the Notre Dame MBA program from a distance and you were in a city like Chicago, they would rent a storefront and every night people would go there for class. That pretty much the way it was, Kevin. And you could talk from there if you wanted.
Weekends or whatever, yeah.
It was like a Hollywood Squares setup, right? For lack of a better term. And people would go there, and he told me that the corporations were paying like $6,000 a class for that. And we started getting on the topic of tuition. I said, well, you know, tuition's awful high. Not a lot of people can afford it. He goes, what are you talking about? We had more applications last year than we ever did. So it's kind of the same thing we're talking about. You know, the Cubs charge an exorbitant amount for these tickets. Hey, what's the problem? We got a waiting list, right? But if you're sort of not careful of being at least aware of, like, my buddy, who, by the way, got laid off 3 months ago, I don't know that he's sending his check in next year. If things are, like, you know, maybe deteriorating around you, and you're so dumb or so arrogant that you don't see it, and you keep raising the prices, you might get a huge surprise. Now, I wonder, Kevin, if we could, too much work for either one of us, if we could take those numbers you came up with, you know, the article you found and went through it, if we could take a study of that and the pricing over the last several years, the price, and, you know, they're not big on expensive beer there. I think it's actually pretty cheap. If you were to do that and zero in on those people working, let's say, downtown St. Louis, I don't know what geography you'd put, what the average raise has been, if how many people are working from home, how many people, how many offices are now vacant. There might not be any, and everybody could be getting a 20% raise, I don't know. But if you could do that study and overlay it on the Cardinals situation, I wonder if you wouldn't find the answer. Or some answer.
Yeah, I don't know. I do want to go back to one point that I made earlier, because this does affect the you know, the pricing and the popularity of it. The Cubs have to sell, let's just say for round numbers, the Cubs want to try and sell 40,000 tickets per game, and if you just look at, forgetting anybody who might, you know, take a busload of people in from Iowa or tourists or anything like that, you're trying to sell those 40,000 tickets to a metropolitan area of about 9.4 million people. And we could do this math on New York too. And in St. Louis, you're trying to sell 40,000 tickets to about 2.8 million in the greater St. Louis and around, and that includes, you know, the Illinois side of the border there. The city itself, you know, has about 280,000 people, and that's it. And Chicago, I don't know what Chicago is nowadays. But
you got to add another little wrinkle to that too, Kevin. And I'm going to say even today, 5,000 to 8,000 of the Wrigley crowds walk up. When I go, I walk. I just walk. You know, you're not going to do that at St. Louis or any other place. Maybe Yankee Stadium, you get there so easy with the subway, but that's another huge advantage that Wrigley has. You're not talking about a metropolitan area. You're talking about a neighborhood. You could fill a place up to 3 square miles around it.
Well, yeah, you could. You absolutely could there. And then you can expand that a little bit with public transit, just like you mentioned with New York. So... Yeah, I think, you know, some cities are in a better position than others to be able to find buyers, you know, because they're spreading across a larger population. That's a factor as well, and that, you know, that's not a fact. When we talk about big market and small market teams, that's probably an advantage to a large market team that I don't ever see discussed. It's just the critical mass for ticket sales. I know ticket sales may not be their primary primary source of revenue, but it's a big source of revenue.
Oh, it's a massive source of revenue. Baseball, it's got to be way more than any other sport in terms of, well, football says no, but God bless. I mean, what's the average seat price at Soldier Field? It's got to be a buck and a half, isn't it? And it's 60,000 people. What is that? You know, $9 million? It's not nothing.
It's not trivial, and we could talk the same thing with football, where, you know, you've got 9.4 million potential buyers for Bears tickets for those 60,000 seats. You know, New York, either of the New York teams is going to have an even bigger critical mass there. Whereas, let's pick out a smaller market team. We could pick out Green Bay. That's probably a anomalous situation. It's probably not the best example.
Well, you got to. It's not really Green Bay. It's Wisconsin, and
that's
half
right.
And half the ticket that's store people in Milwaukee to commute up there.
Anomalous situation, because people drive up from Milwaukee all the time. So I don't know who's a good smaller market team.
Well, I think when you say small market, though, Kevin, again, it's there's a million in Phoenix, for instance. They did a nice job about putting the, again, this has to do with the stadium is downtown baseball, Now, football, I guess people think, people, you know, 8 days a year don't mind getting in their car and traveling, and even if it's a ways, you park. But in baseball, their whole routine is it's close enough downtown where you can pile out of your office, and I think they start the games early enough that if you want to, you can almost, well, the guys pull the little rickshaw, what do they call them here? The rickshaw in China. You can get on one of those things, and the guy will pedal you over there. Their whole shtick was, we're going to make it convenient for the people downtown. And actually, when the Sox built this stadium, and now it's a long time ago, I think I wrote a column when I was writing columns. I said, idiots, put the stadium south loop, have a couple of streetcars or wherever you want to do them, people movers, and start the games at 6 o'clock, where people can go spill right out of work, have one drink in the downstairs bar, don't have to move their car, you don't need as many parking places because everybody can use the downtown spots. You'll knock them dead. Now, boy, I didn't anticipate work from home and downtown 40% occupied, but for the time, I thought it was a terrific idea. Make it as convenient as possible for people to be there. And sometimes I wonder what planet people are on. There's so many customers, I got such a good product. What with the greater mousetrap theory, you know, if I made a better mousetrap, people will find a way to beat a path to my drawer. I don't buy that, do you? I mean, I think you have to. Now, the Cubs are unique in that they're in a neighborhood, and they got the walk in, and they got the L stop right next to them. How many people have that? I mean, Green Bay is unique because half the tickets are still from Milwaukee, right? And people make that commute, even though they make it as hard as possible for those people by having night games I don't think they think a whiff about having the Milwaukee ticket holders having a night game on a Monday, do they? You think they even care? Once you buy them, they don't care.
I mean, fortunately for that franchise, the fan base is so hardcore that they're totally willing to do that and get home, you know, in the wee hours of the morning after a game like that, and they'll just take the next day off.
So. Well, but there's a real lot of marketing theory in all this, and when you talk about baseball or football, you got the added overlay that it is a monopoly, right? If somebody put a stadium in some horse bleep spot in Kansas City, everybody had to go to, and somebody else could form a team and put it where it's like really convenient, my guess is they'd kick the ass of the other team with the same product, essentially. But you can't, right? Because Major League Baseball has the monopoly going. Football pretty much does, too, even though they don't have one. They act like they do. So you have that going for you. You can sort of make these mistakes and not even really care what you do to your ticket base. But I will say this, Kevin, after having them, I can't emphasize enough that in this day and age, if you don't sell them in January, you don't sell them. There were years that I went to 20 games because I had the tickets. What are the chances of me having a long day on the trading floor, instead of saying, I'll just go to a health club for an hour and a half and go downstairs for a drink and go home? How many of those nights would I said, no, I got to get my ass up to Wrigley and buy a ticket at the gate? Any? Maybe a Friday 3:05. None of the rest of them, I wouldn't have been there, would you?
I wouldn't have been motivated. Nope, I wouldn't have been that motivated. Let me put it this way. The team would have to be awfully good. And I think that's probably what you run into. You use Kansas City as an example. 2.2 billion people in the metropolitan area. You better be good. And they are. You know, the Chiefs are anyway.
Well, yeah. But it's also 10 games.
People.
There are people that have tailgated with their buddies for 50 years. And it doesn't matter if you and I were playing wiffle ball there, they would take the opportunity to do that. I mean, at some point you drop people, like you've been saying, but it becomes an event for those people. It's a way for everybody. I mean, if we didn't...
Yeah, Milwaukee's a good example of that, Tom, too, because there's a lot of tailgating for baseball, too. That, you know, the football tailgating tradition has spilled over to baseball. Do people really do any tailgating for Wrigley Field? You can't.
No.
And it's minimal for the White Sox games.
Actually, one lot's pretty good. Larry used to have season.
Well, I understand, but it's just that one lot.
Yeah, that's the one lot. I can't say we got 15 minutes left. Let's talk about the economy, but I guess we need to.
And all along.
Yeah, and it's well, we sort of are, because we've been talking about it. It's the same subject. I mean, what is your view? I mean, because Kevin and I have been, you know, kind of jousting back and forth, not jousting, but discussing one of the oddest things about baseball. And by the way, the gentleman who I was talking about his 80th birthday last year, when it first started happening, when I first came to the trading floor, he was like my mentor. He's the one who gave all the lectures on option theory and so forth, and he actually had tapes where you'd go up there and, you know, he put, boy, Kevin, you gotta like it. You put yourself in his room, it was a VCR tape, black and white, in a room with, like, no ventilation, you closed the door and you sat there for 2 hours and learned about options. But I'll tell you what, you took notes because you didn't ever want to listen to that tape again. It was brutal. But anyway, when baseball first started to do this, I mean, his name's Marty O'Connell, brilliant man. He went to Notre Dame. His senior year, they finally hired Era, so he's that much older than us. And he went to I think the University of Chicago Business School and in Stanford Law. So we're talking about a pretty sharp dude. And he was talking about the baseball, how Marvin Miller, absolutely, the owner's greed made them stupid. They didn't want to give everybody free agency, so they only gave a few people free agency. Yet they were so stupid, and I use that term particularly, they didn't realize that having an auction for only a few people and not everybody was going to distort the prices for those few guys. And then if you added an arbitration clause on top of that, where those few guys set the price, he goes, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen anybody do. And you know what, Kevin, he's right. I don't know if you agree with it or not. That's why he says it's one thing to say only three left fielders that can make a difference on a team are available any given year. He goes, that's dumb enough. But you know that guy's going to be making $1.5 million when the regular guy's making $500 or less. But now the guy who's making the $500 getting to say, well, that's the real price of somebody who's hitting what I'm doing and can play the field like I can. They have an arbitrator. Yeah, that looks like the real price. He goes, it was never the real price because it was a limited auction. And what Kevin and I have been discussing is a perfect example now is this Kyle Tucker on the Cubs. Good ball player, appears to be a terrific guy, solid. And then you ask yourself, what am I paying for? Now, the dude is supposedly, according to my genius in the local bar, we're talking $30 million a year, somewhere around there. And the dude hits 270, hits 30 home runs, and he hits a bunch of RBIs, and he plays good. So you bring up, and I'm not saying anything bad, I won't say anything bad about him at all. I think he's a terrific player. But for me, if I'm the Cubs, not that I'm a general manager, if I pay him 30 and I can bring somebody up or buy somebody else for, let's say, 5, or if it's a rookie, it's 1, and I get 20 less hits, 5 less home runs, a few less RBIs, $25 to $28 million is an awful lot to pay for that, quote, difference. And could I use that $28 million to get, like, 5 other guys and get my 25 hits back? I'm going to say yes. I would never sign one of those guys for that because it's not a fair pricing model. He's worth double one of these other guys. He's not worth 10 times, in my opinion. What do you think about it?
Well, it also depends on what other revenues would be associated with that player. In Tucker's case, I don't think a lot. In Otani's case, I think there is.
Otani's Babe Ruth of our generation. He's a well, outlier.
That and the fact that he opens up this whole market to the Dodgers proprietary live stream stuff in Japan.
You can't count that. I mean, he's different.
But, there are a few Pied Pipers like that, you know, in various sports that may still be local.
Well, Fernando Valenzuela probably was.
Well, yeah, Fernando, I'm even thinking you can look over to football and say there's a lot of people who will go out of their way to watch Patrick Mahomes play because he's good, but he's entertaining too.
And he's likable as hell.
And he's likable, so you have a few of those unicorn types of players, but by and large, no. And especially if you know, if you have, and you if you really think he's that good, and the Cubs obviously think he's that good, if you got Owen Casey waiting in the wings, why do you care? You know, is it really worth 30? Even if you don't get Kyle Tucker's performance out of Casey next year, like you said, you're also not spending $30 million for it, which means you got $30 million of budget money for something else. And so I you know, I think that's a factor. And then you have to factor in, you know, did Tucker take some performance hit trying to play through injuries this year? Well, he also missed a substantial amount of last year due to injuries. Some guys start to break down. You need to worry about that. So it's not just $30 million for next year. You're talking $30 million, maybe a 5-year deal, something like that. I think all those are factors too. And you're right. It's because it's a restricted, you know, we restrict how many can become free agents, that you can look at Tucker and say, well, when healthy, he's one of the best players in baseball. That makes him worth a lot of money. But if you had 10 guys, not one or two, just like him or comparable on the market, then would Tucker or any of them get anything approaching $30 million? The answer is probably no.
Yeah, I don't know where the number is there. If it's 3 or 4, the answer is probably yes. Depends on the position too. I mean, the three shortstops that were available a couple years ago when the Cubs got Swanson, he was like,
yeah, I think Swanson might have been the fourth.
Yeah, he might have been the fourth considered the best. Fourth now he's good. I like him. I mean,
he's a good ball player, and he didn't cost nearly as much as some of the others did. Was Machado on there? Was part of it?
I think so.
He was actually playing third base more than shortstop, but still. And the guy that was on Minnesota sign that he just went back to the Astros. Can't remember.
Well, what about the Packers guaranteeing this guy $120 million, and he's got to have shots in his back to play this week? Yeah, what manner of moron did that for the 120? Not that he's not a great player; he sure is. But I mean, what are you doing with that?
You know what? And yet, when he signed his contract with the Packers, because there's some people that say Jerry Jones knew it when he was trading the guy. But right when he signed the contract, Jerry Jones said, geez, we offered him more guaranteed money than the Packers did. So.
Well, I mean, I have to believe that when it's like selling a house. I mean, I don't know if it's like selling a house, but you got to tell somebody if you got radon. You got to tell somebody if it leaks, right? I mean, I don't see how a transaction of that magnitude, if somebody has a bad back, it's not known or found out.
Well, I'm sure I would think the Packers gave him a physical as well before he signed the contract.
Well, the Bears drafted, two number one picks in a row, the guy from Texas and somebody else, with bad backs, and none of them ever played. Right? I mean, you can luck out on it, but you also maybe not.
The guard that played for them last year that had a bad back when they drafted him, he overcame it. Ooh. I don't want a lineman who's got a bad back, though.
Well, who's the big tackle out of Texas that never even played, like 10 years ago? Tell us his name. You know what I'm talking about. He came out, he was out of Texas or Texas A&M. I don't even think he played his rookie year. But, I mean, you got to be careful. I mean, it's not like it's my money, but I guess it's the theme of the show today, Kevin, is $120 million to some people, and other people are scraping to pay for their tickets, right? I mean, it's just what world you live in. I was wondering, when the market was down so much yesterday, and then it came right back, so you don't have to worry about it being down, I guess, until maybe you do. I wonder if there's an article buried someplace about people like Babe Ruth and so forth. Do you think they all had signed their 1930 contracts before the market crash? Maybe they didn't. I'm just wondering if anybody, I don't know if they had any long-term contracts in those years. I mean, Ernie Banks used to sign his one-year contract in the spring every year. So maybe, I was going to say, if there was long-term contracts back then, after the market crash, how many of them got paid?
Yeah, there really weren't long-term contracts.
No, I mean, how could you? I mean, there wasn't any money for anybody, was there?
Well, they had the reserve clause, too, so they didn't have to. You could not leave your team at the end of the contract. So they pretty much had you over a barrel. And there was a year though, famous Babe Ruth quote, because he was getting paid in the 80,000, 85,000 range, something like that. And that was more than the president made, and somebody asked him about making more than the president. He said, I had a better year than the president.
Well, you know, does anybody think, I mean, now what does a good player make? 10 times what the president makes. That's a little much. Well,
president's working for a buck, so.
Well, they seem to do better than that, maybe especially this guy, but the fact is.
I don't think the president makes league minimum.
No, I don't think he does. League minimum is $1 million.
Yeah, doesn't he make in the salary $400?
I think Clinton.
I don't even know what it is, but it's not, you know, league minimums are almost seven figures now. Good morning.
I'm going to go out on a plank here and say Clinton raised the number from 250 to 450, which is weird because if you do that, you don't get it. The next guy does.
Well, he thought his wife was going to get it. Come on now.
Well, I don't know about that, but either way. But you know, you look at these. But you know what's weird is if you want to see something bizarre, and you see, you know, Hillary had the stuff going for him when they were in Arkansas. But I think, boy, I'm going to say that he had two terms in Arkansas governor, right? But they were separated by a term, sort of like Trump. He was in, he was out, and then he went back in. Is that?
Yeah, I think he. It's one of the. It's like the one time he lost an election or something like that. Yeah.
But I'm going to say that his first term. Well, we probably could get Andrew to look this up. I'm going to say his salary was $4,000 or something. In the second term, it was like $8,000.
You mean governor of Arkansas?
Yeah,
something like you. Yeah, but you can live like a king in our. You know, I grew up right across the river in Memphis. You can live like a king on $8,000 a year.
That would have cost you $150 to go to dinner.
Mean, apparently he was though.
Well,
he would never pay in for dinner. Come on now.
Well, and something we know from the Clintons, the Obamas, you know, you just keep going forward. The money you make after being president is pretty incredible. I don't know how many millions the Obamas are worth. Clinton did it all, you know, all through the foundation, which allowed everybody in the family to have an incredible lifestyle. Paid for by the foundation paid for, and yet it was all not for profit stuff.
But you guys you jump at the outliers. Who was the guy?
I know.
But who was the governor of Illinois? Quinn, he was governor after Rauner, was he? Or he was in there somewhere. The guy's. Could be the world's only honest man that ever ran for something like that. I don't think the guy has a pot to piss in. What does the governor make? $80,000 a year? $100,000? I mean,
and I don't think the governor is good, is something you can parlay into.
Well, but you just said Clinton did or somebody did. I mean.
Well, he parlayed it into a higher office. Sorry for speaking for people, but you know, governor's not something you can parlay into your you know, post governor, you know, millions of dollars for making speeches, etc. One of the former governors, and I can't remember which one it was, used to be on my train every once in a while when I was going downtown every day.
It probably was Quinn.
I think it was. Yeah. I actually think it was. I'm looking up a list and looking up a picture, but. Yeah, it might have been. You know what? It was Rauner.
Might have been Rauner. Well, Rauner had dough, though. Yeah. He came from some. He came from a big business job. He had some money.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it was Quinn. I would. I'd see Quinn every once in a while because he was working regular work.
But I mean, Mike Pence.
Yeah.
If Mike Pence.
I mean, you either had to get a job or you get 3 square meals a day and a little room to live in if you're Illinois governor.
Well, I mean, what if Mike Pence has his shtick is he was in the state legislature, so he got a small pension, not huge, a pension there. Wasn't he, was he a representative too, Kevin?
Yeah, he was in Congress.
So he got that little pension, and he's got the governor. He's got like 3 pensions. Other than that, I don't know if he's got any money. I mean, he's not dying, but I'm saying he in public life, he has those 3 pensions, right? I think he was a school teacher too. He might have one there. He's got like 3 or 4.
He was like, you know, I mean, he was like a coach or something.
Yeah. So, but I mean, but I mean, it's not like the dude's got, you know, I don't think he ever wrote a book, and I don't know, is anybody paying for him? I'd be interested in listening to him. I don't know if a company wanted to pay $500,000 to get him there, but I mean, why wouldn't you want to listen to a guy who was a VP?
He declared his net worth is about $4 million when he took a short run at president.
Okay.
So I mean, and that's and Dr. Odemiak and I know that you can live like a all three of us know you can live like a king on that in Indiana, can't you?
Well,
pretty darn well, yeah.
We have Dr. Odemiak. Hey, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Andrew was asking me on the way in this morning, hey, we're going to have Dr. Odemiak. She makes the show better. I know she does. I hope she's on.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Why don't I turn the show over to your two guests, and I'll just listen in.
Because I don't know, Doctor, if you've been listening, but for once in my life, the last couple of weeks, I've had somewhat of a theme in the sense that There's people making all kinds of economic decisions, and you wonder if they're all sort of on the same page in their view of the world. I mean, you look at, you know, the Bears trying to build a stadium in Arlington Park for $5.5 or $6 billion. They obviously have a view of the future. You have other people that are getting laid off that had sort of a different view of the future. What's the right view? I mean, you look at baseball and we started this show talking about how the Cardinals are dropping like a rock in season ticket holders. Now, is that a function of the team not being quite as good, or maybe there aren't as many people in downtown St. Louis? But basically, your season ticket base has dropped from maybe 30,000 to 18,000, if you sort of do the math, in 2 or 3 years, which is a bleep load for a team. You know, because I think don't take this wrong, but if you're not in West Lafayette or Bloomington, you're not going to get a walk-up crowd. If you don't sell tickets in January, you basically don't sell them in big cities, but or even a city the size of St. Louis. I mean, what's the true view of what's going on here? I mean, in terms of the future, and I think you probably have as good a view of that as anybody. So I'd love your interpretation.
Well, I think the challenge is, the view is really bipolar, because you have the economic impact impacting people disproportionately, right? So you have groups of people who have no problem buying tickets, and even if the Cardinals are bad, and I apologize, I am not a Cardinals fan.
They've been the absolute class of the mid-market team that is 43,000 people there every year, and have been since Stan Musial played. And all of a sudden,
I'm not
all
a
of a sudden,
Cardinals because I like the Cubs.
Well, no, but I'm saying all of a sudden they're dropping like a stone.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So go ahead.
I grew up a Cardinals fan because everybody in Memphis was a Cardinals fan. They were the closest major league team to us. And they were a big regional draw, but I think what really has hurt them is, they in Memphis, everybody knows somebody that works for FedEx, and FedEx sponsors the basketball arena, and I think FedEx is on the Grizzlies jerseys and all that kind of stuff. Well, Anheuser-Busch, heaven forbid, 20 years ago, you go down to St. Louis and order a Miller Lite somewhere.
Sure.
I mean, I know somebody that did that once. We were talking, in the 90s, somebody I worked with said, oh, yeah, because I was a Bud Light guy, he was a Miller Light guy, and he mentioned how, he couldn't find one in St. Louis. He had to go to a couple of different bars or something, kind of as a joke. But the point is, the Cardinals were closely associated with the brewery and the Bush family and all that kind of stuff. So being a Cardinal fan was something that you really did not have much of a choice if you grew up in St. Louis. Well, Anheuser-Busch is now owned by a European company, and I don't even think, they're not directly associated with the baseball team anymore. So the whole civic thing has kind of fallen apart for them. And I really think that St. Louis is unique with respect to ticket sales falling off a cliff. because they always had that diehard wearing the red Sansa belt, I'm going to every game I can go to fan that has just, you know, kind of thrown their hands up because they're not any good anymore. But also, I just don't think that the Cardinals are like this big civic pride thing down there. But at a very macro, if you take the mid-tier, you know, the mid-tier teams versus the large city teams, I think when the economy's slowing, middle, you know, smaller cities like St. Louis and Indianapolis and Memphis and places like that, they get hit more when we have economic slowing than big cities like Chicago. You just feel it more in places like that. And remember the old Super Bowl indicator that if the NFC wins, it's, you know, it's really good for asset prices and the stock market, et cetera. Well, that's because the NFC teams were all big market teams and the AFC teams were small market teams. And there was a belief that, you know, the big market teams could buy better players and do better. I don't know if the philosophy's there or not, or, you know, if it holds up in reality, but that was the belief. I think the same thing when we, you know, see economic slowing. Back in the 70s, that, you know, you could say that the designator hitter role was a direct result of how crappy the economy was in the 70s. That they were trying to keep some of the, you know, that they were trying to allow Hank Aaron to play three or four more years so people would still show up and see a guy like Hank Aaron play.
Yeah, except I don't think he ever was a designated hitter.
No, he finished his career. Didn't he go back to Milwaukee?
I'm not sure if he did that.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think he was
But that was the idea behind the designated hitter, was, you know, to help the smaller market teams. And that's why it was in the American League and not necessarily not in the National League as well.
A doctor would start. Kind of started this. One of my buddies has. He shares season tickets for the Cubs, so he essentially owns one seat. So there's four people, and they split it up, 25% of the seats, and mm-hmm. you know, and they're not. They're out. They're past the bullpen and maybe the eighth row, so they're outfield reserved or some crap. I don't know. But in other words, they're not infield boxes. They're probably $70 a ticket, something along those lines. So his share every year is $6,400. You know, and the dude just got laid off.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but that's a big check after tax, right? What is it? What's that before tax? 10G.
And it's a big check, and it's for something you can watch on TV.
And all of a sudden now, the Cubs are in. Well, they're giddy because if you have this. I think if you get the first wild card spot, you get to host the 2 out of 3 series or something. So they could be getting 3 games there. Well, he just gets the bill $1,650, and they want it like next week. I don't know that he's got $1,650 to send him, or wants to. Now the Cubs, I think he probably could sell those and get his money back. In which case, he'd be a wholesaler. But still, the Cubs' view of how great this is all going, I don't know if it's the same view of maybe the Skybox fans, but I don't know about the Schlump fans, which I used to be. This is kind of big money for people, and I don't think there's a recognition of that. I mean, that's why I asked the doctor what there's different views of the world. You know, mm-hmm. some people you go in the store, there's some people cutting coupons. And then, you know, there's other people, you know, looking at Porsches. I don't think I've ever seen the economy quite this split.
Well, and it's funny you should mention that about the Cubs season tickets. I sometimes think that selling tickets, your season tickets for, like, single game tickets can be challenging. I had a buddy who had season tickets for a long time, and, like, a Thursday May game, you couldn't give them away.
So that's why I dropped mine. Do you know how to read people's minds over the telephone? Because that's exactly what happened to me. When I couldn't give them away, I said, "This is crazy."
It's crazy, right? And then and if the Cubs do make it into the playoffs, hopefully you could sell some of those playoff tickets to recoup your cost. But that's a lot of speculation about the Cubs' ability.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I was saying when Russell knows who he is, the guy who helps me do the manage money, Larry. They had Sox season tickets like forever, and I don't know what year this was. And I think you can do it a lot easier now. But his first couple of years, when you started to be able to list your tickets for sale, I think he had to do it through the White Sox site or somebody's site. You couldn't list them for under face. Now you're trying to sell a game that, you know, isn't maybe one of the best games. And I think there was a 20% fee.
Oh, geez.
So he had to list them for like 120% of face just to get them on the site.
Oh, yeah, StubHub takes 15%.
Maybe it was 15%, but it was...
No, well, you know, you guys were talking about it the first hour, so I looked it up. That's all.
But I think the Sox might have charged
you. I think
the Sox might have charged 5 or something. The 20... But the... Our buddy Ricketts was actually at one of those security traders things, and he's a speaker. So, Doctor, I'm one of the losers. I raised my hand, and I go, hey, you know... I've been a season ticket holder for like a real long time, and I said, you know what that really means, and I'm sure you know that because he was a trader. I said, I'm really your wholesaler, because I can't go to 80 games a year. I'm going to go to 20. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, Big Don went to 20. I didn't tell him I shared him. I made it sound like I had the whole thing, but I said, you know, if I can't find people to pay the price on there, he goes, I love the Cubs. But I'm not willing to take a loss as a wholesaler. And, you know, where every time I buy a ticket from you at 40, I got to sell it at 20. You know, I'm not going to do that. I can't do it. And by the way, I wouldn't even if I could. I said, so you have to be careful that you don't bury your wholesalers. Because then they were starting to do this stuff about the, you know, the crummy games were $20, the good games were $60, that kind of crap. And he kind of looked at me like I had two heads. What do you think I was? Do you think I couldn't wait to get my fanny in there 80 times a year? I mean, who can do that? I mean, in business, you know, Doctor, you mentioned the same thing. I had guys in the trading floor that bought some, and I could always give them away. You know, a broker or some clerk always wanted to go. All of a sudden, I couldn't give them away, and I said, I can't give these things away. This is crazy.
Yeah.
But
exactly. But I mean, again, and it's those games that, like, in May where the weather's bad. Because there's a lot of variability for whether or not do you get the good matchup, but sitting out and watching a ball game in the rain is not fun. I've done it.
Well, especially if it's a night game in April when they know it, they're doing it to you.
Nobody wants to do that.
Hey, I want to ask. I've had actually lately for we've had a lot of new interest. Clients, which is, you know, good for PTI, good for me, but everybody who comes in, it takes a lot of study. You know, you have to look at their portfolio, look at their age, look at other stuff they may have. I mean, it's a lot of work to bring in a new client and to do it properly. You know, obviously, if you're, you know, some firm that just puts everybody in the same round hole, you can do it in a second. But when we don't do that, and I want to ask both of you when you. I've gotten a few portfolios lately from people, and the concentration in there is somewhat dramatic. But the good news is it's been like life-changing for these people. Like a lot of them bought a lot of Apple. It was like $11, that kind of thing, and some people have Microsoft. I mean, they've zeroed in on the winners, okay, for lack of a better term, because... Over time, maybe you get rid of losers and you hang on to the winners and it becomes a cathedral, not a stock. You can't. But normally, I would say if you just look at the numbers, and I've talked about this with Russell, I've never seen big stocks this traditionally, I'll use the term, overvalued in terms of revenue per share. And I mean, the fact that Microsoft is 11, 12, 13, 15 times revenue, a stock that big, I can't even imagine it, but it is. Now, but you see the thing last night with Google, and all these stocks are up today. Is it a possibility that in the new economic order we seem to have in this country that we're going to identify 40, 50 stocks, and they're going to be the only 40, 50 stocks? I mean, in somewhat of a very, you know, this is not putting people on railroad cars, and a very fascist economic system where the government's going to determine who the winners and the losers are. I mean, I think what the Google decision yesterday, what the decision is or what it didn't, what they didn't say, doesn't mean crapo. What it says is, our people here are never going to break up or fine any of these companies in terms of antitrust to any reasonable extent. So if that's the case, maybe Microsoft is worth 14, 15 times revenue, because 10 years from now, there's only going to be 10 companies left. What do you feel about that? I know that's a big question, but it's a new wrinkle that I never thought I'd have to put into my brain. I mean, it is a wrinkle. There's reason. I mean, there's a reason why these things are this high. What's the answer here?
So I want to first address that your clients that you're looking at, there's something called survivorship bias. So there might be a lot of people who picked a lot of losers and held on to them, but they'll never be your clients because they didn't develop the net worth. So you're now dealing with a subset of people who, I don't know if it's luck, deep evaluation, however they came into this portfolio and held on to these positions, they're now their survivors. So it might appear that we've got a situation where we've got these top companies, but again, the reason why we're looking at them is because of the survivorship bias. We're only looking at companies that have really stood the test of time, and it's a challenge of being able to then tease out some of that information so that we can have a better view of the entire landscape.
Well, we've never, without any regard to anybody's politics or whatever, we've sort of never seen a situation where the big companies have made the trek, you know, essentially to the Oval Office with a briefcase. What did they buy there? I mean, did they buy antitrust exemption? I mean, what are the new rules, I guess, is my question. Or are there new rules? I mean, are they... I mean, when I say this because a long story, but I spent some time in Germany in 1991 lecturing and stuff. And I don't know how much you guys... I mean, I know Russell probably does, but it's a whole different world than here. It was three or four companies in every industry. Banks kind of owned a lot of the stock of the companies, and every bank had their nose firmly up the ass of the government. It was so controlled. It was no young people could open up a new firm. There was no entrepreneurial feeling whatsoever. It was these people were locked in tighter than a tick on a dog, and you weren't going to move them. And it seems like sort of we're moving that way here. And I find it sort of horrifying, but I don't know what to do about it. I mean, and how do I value things based that way? I guess it's a lot of questions there. But then again, you guys are professors.
Yeah, I don't disagree with your assessment about how these big firms are moving in lockstep. And again, I think part of it is this idea that these are companies that have been able to maybe work with the government, become large enough, become in demand enough, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're spectacular companies. Perhaps maybe they're just playing the game better than other companies.
Does that scare you a little bit?
It does for me. I'm a libertarian.
Well, there you go. What about you, Russell? I mean, I don't know how you... It seems like it's kind of the direction it always gets that way. I mean, when you look at, you know, say the president, he hadn't said it yet, but some of his creatures have said we ought to buy some of these defense companies. Now, out of the blue, to me, and I think Russell's got this, and if I can find it, Doctor, I'll send it to you if I can anywhere I can find stuff. Lou sent us a list. How far back did that go, Russell? Was it like 30 years, 35 years? A list of all the combinations that have been in the defense industry. And one side
oh,
of the,
and how they all have basically funneled into about, you know, just a handful of companies at this point.
Now, if somebody would have said 35 years ago the government wanted to buy a piece of this place or that place, I wouldn't have given it a second thought. But now that it's combined sort of on its own to where there's, what would you say, Russell, five left, if they start becoming chunks of ownership of one of those places, what if the three of us want to get in the defense business? How the hell are we going to do it?
Well, we're not going to do it, but, you know, you could say the same thing when there... Okay, let's say there's three now, but you could say the same thing back when there were 30. If they were only going to invest in two or three of them, that suddenly gives a really nasty competitive advantage versus the other 27.
Oh, yeah.
No argument there. You know, I mean, which way are you going about picking the winners on that one? Are you doing it when, you know, there's dozens of them, which I think is even less fair? I don't have a problem with government stepping in there with large critical industries, especially after the experience we had around COVID, where we had such supply chain disruptions. And in any situation where you think that, you know, where you just look around and you think it's important that we be able to take care of ourselves and not be dependent on any outside forces, I don't have much of a problem with investing in that in those areas. And semiconductors are really that area.
Well, Doctor, I want you to critique our friend Russell here, because people on the show said, you know, Chief, what are you worried about? We did that with Chrysler, we did that with GM. But, you know, I'm old enough to remember the Chrysler situation. It was a very tough deal. Lee Iacocca basically had to go to everybody's office in Congress and basically drop his pants. And he had to beg those people, saying that we had to have a third car company, competition. It's almost exactly the opposite argument that Russell's kind of bringing up now. His point was we needed to remain competitive. And it was probably the hardest dollar anybody ever got out of Congress. And the country was kind of appalled. And the idea was he paid it back as quick as he possibly could. And because everybody realized we don't want to be doing this. We did it for a special case. Let's let those guys survive. Let us pay them back and go on. That's not the attitude now. Now the attitude is, no, we should do this and just kind of stay there. We should always own a piece of you. To me, maybe just because I'm older, the difference in attitude is dramatic. Now, maybe the outcome will turn out to be the same, but the government had no business, had no intention of being a long-term partner with Chrysler. It was a bailout to keep something competitive because of a problem. I mean, I don't know if you guys even, if you weren't sort of there, if you could even understand the difference in attitude, but it was a massive difference in attitude.
I've read up on that whole deal because it was, yeah, I that was late 70s, early 80s. Yeah. So I was just, you know, my mind was just starting to form because I was a young teenager at that time, but I was already kind of interested in the business world. So Iacocca was kind of he was a big hero to me, having done some of the things that he had done, and the stories behind it. All right, like of them, because, you know, this is pre-computer age and everything. They were running around from investment bank to investment bank and government agency with grocery carts full of the documents that they needed to make this thing happen.
Well, that dude must have gone through a pair of shoes a day.
Oh yeah, I mean it does the story behind it. It probably should be remade into a movie. You know, another movie. I know they've done it before. But you know, it was unprecedented back then. It really was that government was gonna, you know, bail out a company. And but yeah, I don't recall, and you know, I wouldn't have heard this part, but I don't really recall the other two automakers pushing back and saying that they shouldn't do this.
Well, it's pretty hard to say there should be only two left in a country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, not saying that they believed, but they didn't really object to it, and it did long term turn out well. And you know, the same thing happened with some of the you know, with some companies coming out of the crisis in 2008. I mean, basically the government took a stake in AIG.
Well,
I was going to say the same thing, Russell.
Yeah,
this is not that different, and it's interesting that you're talking about that Chrysler deal, and I feel like that actually set a precedent. And now my students right now, because we've been starting to discuss some of these things, are very comfortable with the government stepping in and working with some of these companies to make sure that there's not an issue with supply chain or there's not a blip in the financial markets. And to your point, Chief, I think it's a generational thing where before, because it was unprecedented, that wasn't something we were accustomed to, something we're going to expect. But now we're in a situation where, because it's happened so frequently, we're weirdly comfortable with it. I'm not saying that's a good thing to be comfortable with it, just that we are comfortable with it.
Well, you know, it's going to sound really stupid, but if somebody you're walking down to work and every day somebody comes out and kicks you in the ass once, first week you're kind of, I guess after a year of it, you sort of get used to it, huh?
Right.
I mean, it is stunning to me what people have been able to do kind of gradually. Because if you take it to its, me for sure and Russell, you're a little more varied, shall we say, doctor. But Russell and I mean, our lives, to a certain extent, are involved about the markets and how that's how you go get capital. That's what the bond market's for. That's what the stock market's for. We don't normally get capital by, taking a valise full of cash to Mar-a-Lago and having the government buy into your place. I mean, that is so un-American to me. And yet, like you say, other people say, what's the problem? The government just invests in the place. To me, it goes right to the core of what we are or aren't. I mean, I know I'm a little extreme on this, but Russell, I think you're sort of in the middle on this between me and the students.
I'm in the middle on it because I do believe if you're competing, and I try to look at this from a global standpoint. I believe if we are having to compete with entities around the world that really want to knock us off of off of our pedestal, we've got to compete in the same way. And every week if we talk about China, I talk about how the people that I dealt with from China professionally when I was at SIBO were under the impression that SIBO was partially owned by the city of Chicago, because they had if you run a company in Shanghai and it has the word Shanghai in it, the city of Shanghai or the town or whatever their government structure is at the city level owns part of that entity. There are a lot of benefits to being partnered with the government.
Okay, but why? Would anybody, mm-hmm. anybody on Earth, you for sure, because you've been to all these places, would anybody think that the Chinese system is better than ours? Why would we want to be more like them?
You know what? There are some. I'm not saying that we should totally replicate it. I do think that. If you go back and look at some of the things that were said, Obama wanted to emulate the Chinese system.
In what way?
He did. He did. He said, by building out infrastructure.
Well, that part, I mean,
I'm not telling you it made any sense, man. But he said,
no. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about.
I don't think anybody believes that we should be, we should be totally emulating the system. But if we've got to compete with it. And they have, and companies that our companies are having to compete with have the full force of their government to the point of espionage. Should we not be helping our national champions out in the same way?
I don't have somewhat of an issue with that on the defense level, but what we're saying here, the three of us, boy, it's, to be honest with you, it's kind of frightening to me. Somewhere along the line, the people that you and Dr. Demiak teach, if they see a hole in the supply chain or something, in my world, in the American world, the thing that set us apart, that's what the three of us do. We go get a loan and we fill the hole. We don't go to government and tell them there's a hole there and then give money to their buddy to fill the hole. I mean, there's a million decisions that go on in this country economic every second. We don't want to.
I'm going to tell you what the problem, what the ultimate problem would be if government keeps partnering with companies, is if government starts directing them to exactly what they should do. And that's what happens over in China, and I don't think that would ever happen here.
Oh, boy, I think we're well on our way.
A 10% equity stake in Intel to help them be more competitive. And, I dug into that a little bit. Some of that money was earmarked for just helping the semiconductor industry in the U.S. across the board, and it actually had been approved in the previous administration.
I understand it.
Yeah, but taking a 10% stake as opposed to, is the U.S. government going to have government officials overseeing everything that Intel does in their headquarters?
I think it depends on the government.
Because that's what the Chinese Communist Party does.
All right, but how do you... You've got a Russell limit on how far they can push it. And two things you said there, which kind of chill me a little bit, is because the money was apportioned, we have to piss it away somewhere. If you can't find a home for it, take it back. By the way, we're broke.
Saying that. I'm just saying that it's not like, you know, he wrote a full check. This was money that was supposed to be going toward that anyway.
Well,
that is a critical area with respect to us being self-sufficient.
Okay, now this is a quick question for the doctor here.
I'd like to jump in though.
Yeah, go ahead.
To Russell's point, one of the things that has me concerned about, and I'd be very curious of your thoughts about this too, Russell, is I feel like my students almost have a hopeless feeling. In the retirement class in particular, we were talking about whether or not the future generations are going to be able to save anything. So again, everything that's happening in the economy is happening disproportionately. So younger people are very fearful that the amount of expenses they're going to have won't be covered by future salaries. And my concern is when you have people that fearful, it's much easier for them to rely on the government. And to your point, will the government step in and say to Intel, this is what you need to do? My concern is that a group of fearful young people might actually say, please, government, tell us what to do, because they're very concerned about being able to eat, having a roof over their head. And so those are the constructs that, as we're starting to discuss this, that are going through my mind of that's a fundamental problem that we need to really take a look at with this economic disparity between generations, wealth distribution, things along those lines. Because again, whenever you have a scared population, it allows for the government to really step in and do more than, in my opinion, what the government should be able to do.
Well Doctor, along those lines, I mean, the thing that is kind of chilling me a little from what you're saying this morning is it doesn't appear that a lot of these young people, by the way, I talked to a bunch of them here, not as many as you guys, and there isn't an entrepreneurial thought in anybody's mind. They don't have the idea of, I mean, let's take the Intel situation. Russell knows my computer's 15 years old here. It's got an Intel chip inside. There was a day when the only reason why ADM was around because they were somebody's half-assed idea of a competitor, right? The stock traded for $2. And yeah, you could get an ADM chip if you really wanted one, but they sort of sucked. And Intel controlled the world. And they got nothing but money, bonuses basically out the behind. And all of a sudden, they have dragged and dragged and dragged. And to the point where I don't know if the market wants to give them any money. I don't know if they could go out and get a big bond thing. All of a sudden, we pick that name out and we give them this dough. Do you think for a second that there was rigorous hard study of the entire chip world and find out there might be 5, 10, 200 people trying to get off the ground in the chip manufacturing area that need an infusion of cash? Intel, to me, is a corporate dead dog. They haven't done anything for 20 years. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to give them money. All this is going to change. I mean, do we know that? I mean, who's on the cutting edge now? Is it them? Is it not? I'm not saying anything horrible about them. All I know is they were huge, and now they're not. And, I mean, if we're going to do this, how are we going to do it? Are we going to do it through the press? Is it always going to be the biggest company? Or are we going to actually find somebody that you guys might have taught 5 years ago that has a little chip somewhere, company somewhere that's trying to go out and borrow some money, and he's borrowing it on his credit card? I mean, it is so uneven how we're doing this. That's my concern. Doctor, would you want to talk to that, or am I just nuts?
No, I actually had a student approach me yesterday, and he had an entrepreneur idea, and we were discussing different phases of it. And one of my big arguments was, who are you going to eventually sell the company to? And then I said, once you really start to think about that and start working backwards, I said, well, and how are you going to get funding for things? And he says, oh, we don't need funding.
And I said, what do you mean? How do you do that?
I said, that's what I said to him. And we started discussing some of the costs associated with funding this. And again, this is a student, as an undergraduate student, so very young, very pleased that he was thinking entrepreneurially. But on the other hand, some of the, where is that money coming from? And he said, well, I've been paying for stuff like this. And to your point, he is putting it on credit cards. He's, yeah. And again, this is obviously a very small venture, but this is how things get started.
At 25%, though, and the other guys are borrowing 3.
Right.
Well, it's, so there's, you brought up something, you know, it's funny, Decker, that's why I love having you on. You bring up stuff that all of a sudden my mind just jumps from one topic to the next. You brought up the idea of putting a company together so you can sell it to somebody. Now, to me, that puts almost a shiver right up my spine, because I have we have a lot of clients, we have some doctors that are clients and so forth, and they all like to invest in a lot of these startup, you know, a drug company or something, or somebody's got an idea, whether it's a medical device or whether it's a drug. And the weird part of it is, every single one of them, the thought of finding a new cancer drug or something and actually making a lot of money, and by the way, helping a hell of a lot of people out because you could help cure a cancer or two or something, that doesn't even cross anybody's mind. It's coming up with something until one of the big guys, that all they seem to do is scour the earth for anybody with any kind of innovation, for them to come and buy you out. The thought of you actually becoming a competitor to, your Lilly's or somebody like that, or Merck, it's not happening. They are going to control the world for the next 100 years if we let them, just by buying stuff from other people. Sort of like Microsoft. I mean, if they had an invention in 30 years, it's really theirs, or they just wait and see Russell to invent something and they buy it. Is that our world going forward? I mean, you just mentioned that. Nobody thinks that they're actually going to be able, they want to be in, make enough of a splash to where somebody comes in and says, I'll buy your place for $2 billion and don't worry, I'll take care of it from then on. Again, that's not my world, but it is the world. What do you think about that?
Well, one, I'd be very curious what Russell's going to invent, and I'd be excited to get on the ground floor running. So that sounds pretty good. But I do think that to some extent that's true.
Try and take a drug to market yourself. Good luck.
Yeah, you would eventually need to get some help from it. I'm actually working on a drug trial study thing right now, and it's very rare that you have companies that are single drug companies anymore. The same thing, you know, do you know why Google is called Alphabet officially now? It's because they bought so many other small companies that they've got enough that they could fill the full alphabet.
Yeah,
that's
and,
interesting. I didn't know that.
I kid you not. Yeah, that's where the alphabet name comes from. It's from all the if I were to come up with some really cool algorithm that replicated AI and you could do it on your own PC, Google would buy that stuff from me so darn fast.
Yeah, oh yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, and it's really why we're, it really is why the private equity market is where I know Dr. A and I get this a lot from students. They want to work in private equity now. That's the area that's most attractive to them. And I think that area has become very attractive because a lot of companies that you invest in and you cash out in the private equity space never even make it to going public anymore. They just get bought out by a much larger competitor.
And I'm going to say that's somewhat unhealthy, but that's me.
Oh, I think it is too. Yeah.
Well, back when I first started the conglomerates, I mean, I was real young, but the first conglomerate, you guys know this history, and I'm going to test you. The first conglomerate probably was ITT, wouldn't you say, Russell?
I don't know. Was National Cash Register?
Well, no, I'm not talking about a company. I'm talking about a conglomerate where they bought up all kinds of other stuff. Okay. I mean, International Telephone and Telegraph bought his. Then there was Litton Industries. Remember those guys?
I do remember those
guys.
And then
this one I never knew much about, but it was. Remember Ling Temco Vought? Was that the name of it? They bought up a whole bunch of people. And actually, the whole idea was you could whatever anybody was doing, you could do better because your management.
LTV.
Okay, yep, sorry. Yeah. It was that Ling Temco Vought. I don't know who was Ling and who was Temco. I have no idea. But
I don't know, but Vought, he was a jerk. I have no idea who that is.
But
I don't know.
The thing of it was, they got over their own skis so far that they screwed up to the point where they fell on their own weight, which probably, you know, in a view that you guys would give in class, is probably somewhat healthy. But now if we're going to allow them to reach into the government trough and say, we're so big you can't let us fall, I don't know that that's good going forward.
I think it's okay. And I know when you say it's okay in certain situations and not others, you open a huge can of worms. But so LTV, since you brought them up, you know, they were instrumental in the survival of Tom Hanks on the island because they were Wilson's Sporting Goods and they made made his best friend. But also, they were Wilson's Sporting Goods, National Car Rental. They had a steel company. They had resorts in Acapulco and Guerrero, Mexico. I've never heard of Guerrero, Mexico. And Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The point that I am getting ready to make is, other than saving that national treasure, Tom Hanks, LTV did not do anything that I would consider instrumental to the survival. They had an aerospace. But, you know, their big businesses were not critical to the survival of the United States. We'll get by without our volleyballs. You know, the critical industries, steel, you want to be able to make your own steel, period. You know, we should, I'm sure that you also want to make sure that the quality of that steel is what you want. And apparently some of the construction issues they have in China is because they have subpar, you know, steel.
Or stuff's horrible.
Corners, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you know, there are just certain... I mean, if we backtracked 100 years, you want to make sure we can feed ourselves. You want to make sure that we can power our homes, you know, and we can house our people. That really, those types of things. In an information age, you also, you know, there are other things that are kind of instrumental to our day to day.
But why?
I'm sitting here, you know, on a laptop looking up information while we're talking on the radio. You know, being able to get quick access to information is just it's instrumental to a lot of people's jobs and a lot of people's livelihoods now.
Dr. Referee is here.
If
what Russell's saying is first of all absolutely true. We need steel, but why is it that the government, the state of Illinois, the city of Chicago, can't go out and say, by the way, we're building 50 bridges. Here's our bill of material. We need all this steel. The federal government says, by the way, we're building 5 aircraft carriers, and we need all this. If the market is there and we need it, why can't 3 people like us go to the bond market? Go to the stock market and create a steel company? Why do we say all of a sudden now that it has to be government owned? I mean, in every other industry, that's the beauty of our system is people. How if you know you got all these customers right up your behind, how do you not form a steel company? I mean, duh.
Well, there's the capital intensity behind that one. And the anything that has a long lead time to get up and running automatically becomes prohibitive for individuals. And you've brought up the chip example a couple of times. Why can't we start a chip company? Do you know what is involved in building chip fab?
Big topic of conversation yesterday.
Uh-huh. Chip fab's ridiculously expensive.
But I'm saying in terms of now all of a sudden we need steel.
Brought up
Go ahead,
and you brought up a good point of why can't we just go to the bond market as three individuals? Well, as three individuals, we really can't go to the bond market.
But what I'm saying is why, if U.S. Steel has all these clients, and U.S. Steel actually knows some of the history of this because of my guys at Pullman. You know, obviously, we used a lot of steel there. You know, after the war, we became less and less competitive with the European places that we essentially bombed, and because all the stuff here was open hearth, and it's open hearth is somewhat inefficient, but guess what, the open hearth furnaces last like four generations, so maybe four centuries. So U.S. Steel never, they were tied in enough to government and other people that they were able to sell stuff a little less efficiently than other people. And there were a few other what's the other steel company, Russell, that actually is way more efficient than them? What's the name of the guys that use all the new technology? And there's a few other steel companies. Now the question is:
is it Nippon Steel?
Nippon bought some people here. Inland was a little more competitive, I believe, and they got bought. Mm-hmm. Did they get bought by Nippon? I'm not sure, but there's other.
U.S. Steel got bought out by.
Well, that's the thing we just arranged, but
yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm saying there were other people. There was Bethlehem. There was all those kinds of people. There were probably four or five different places I could almost name, and all of them managed to stiff their employees. They're all the pensions they never get. It's if you want to look at the demise of some of the steel industry, it's like a who's who of who screwed up everybody. But the point is that there still is now. There's a reason why these guys have not invested. They just never did since World War II. I mean, the stuff over in Gary, I think, is still open hearth, for God's sake. And I mean, everybody else in the world, they're not. Okay, so now the question is, if there's enough of a buyer there, I'm just saying once you turn this corner, you kind of turn it for everybody. Now, why were steel companies allowed to become so inefficient? Maybe it was easier to buy foreign steel. Maybe we let that go.
Well, that's where the issue comes up. My favorite is I feel like I keep reusing my examples here, but the guy that the last surgical mask maker in the U.S.
who
wasn't making them anymore around COVID, I had a reporter say, "Well, why don't you get up and running and make us a bunch of masks?" And he said, "Well, because I'll do that. I'll spend a lot of money get up and running. I might make a little bit of money, but then as soon as everything calms down, everybody's going to turn to China again, and I'm going to have to close my factory down."
Well, if you go to the
why should I go through all of that?
Well, it's been very imbalanced, and I don't know if you listen at all when Carl's on Doctor, but he talks a lot about some of it, and this should maybe never been allowed to happen, and it's kind of a different way of tariffs than, you know, maybe our current president's using them. But and it goes back to the example of if we have pollution laws here, and I can't dump crap into the Rio Grande, I can't go across the river, not have a pollution law in Mexico where I can dump crap in the Rio Grande and expect the guy here to be competitive. So,
right.
So to Carl's point, the nations that, I mean, and I blame, you know, some of our corporate leaders here have the morals of a wildebeest or something. But basically, when we go to China, what are we doing? We're offloading child labor and we're offloading pollution, right? We're offshoring. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, and you know what? That sucks. And now, should there be some sort of you can't hire 14-year-old girls to sew blue jeans, but I can start a plant up in China and hire 14-year-old girls and do blue jeans and compete with people here. Well, I don't know how you fight that, but you at least have to identify it and say, and then here, to your point earlier, Doctor, I remember what you say, somebody from a family in West Lafayette or Chicago or someplace, they walk into the store and they see the blue jeans that are $20 for their kids, and kids run through them once a week or something. They're going to buy the ones from $20 over there instead of the ones for $30 here, because guess what? They don't have the $30. So right. It becomes this big wheel that just keeps spinning, don't you think? Somehow we've got to find a way to put a spoke in the wheel someplace, but where?
And again, when you start to think about that spoke, we're still talking about people's lives.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the poor family that can't afford the $30 jeans. We're talking about the child workers in China there's all of these people's lives that are being, and because if you take away that job in China, what happens to those people as well? So it's if you were to stop those jobs, and I am not, let me be very clear, I am not supporting child labor, but we have an ecosystem that's dependent on it, and really thinking through the disruptions for all of those phases and really thinking about the impact of those individuals, because they're actual people that are struggling and trying to figure out how to make this work.
But you know that the biggest example of what can happen and would happen if some country all of a sudden did that was right here. And you guys know this as professors. If you go back, you look at the employment tables, and I still have it someplace. If you go back the employment, if you go back before the 40s or the 30s, actually Roosevelt did this. If you look at the population available to work, the age is 16. If you go back to before the 30s, the age was 14.
Right.
And the Roosevelt administration, I believe, they said, guess what? You can't work before 16. So you guys being economics professors immediately pops into your head, wait a minute. We took these people out of the workforce. We've lowered the supply, which means these people actually got to pay more to get somebody 16 instead of 14. It was an incredible plus all across the board for everybody. Maybe not in a month or two, but in a year or two. And I'm probably going to say in China, which I have no, Russell maybe could become a party member over there, but I can't. If they were to do that, I'm going to say it's a net plus for them for the next 100 years, just like it was here. Now, yeah, does a 14-year-old lose a job? Okay, maybe. But the 16-year-old in the family now has to get paid a little more, right? So, I mean, at some point, I think the economics actually works and the free market actually works. And everybody finds a way to say it shouldn't be free for me. You know, it's like, what was the quote, Russell? Every competition is the greatest thing for every industry in the world except mine, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, because look, these guys are a cutthroat competition type of thing. And I just don't want to go down that road, because I don't want to become one of these other places that everything's structured with a few people making the decisions. But I think I'm losing that battle, Doctor. What do you think?
I don't know if you're losing that battle. So there's still people that think a little bit more normally as far as I have to get out there and make sure somebody's not going to catch up with me, et cetera.
Well, I'm concerned.
You know,
do you guys,
I they're still out there. We Dr. A and I see them.
Well, what is Doctor? Go ahead.
And we don't know what the next 5 or 10 years are going to be. So again, some of my students' attitudes could find out that they're wrong, and that they will be able to cover their expenses. We don't know. And so that generation, their viewpoints could easily change, as opposed to right now being a little struck of how to move forward.
When you say that, again, you're kind of chilling me a little, Doctor, because in 1991, when Dr. J and I went over to Europe and gave some lectures, right, and I first saw like how the other world lives, and I was kind of horrified. We would go out to, many, many adult beverages, shall we say. The people we were lecturing to on option trading, not one of them was a floor trader. Not one of them was their money. They all worked for a bank. They'd sit in a bank and trade options, make markets, basically, but they were bank employees. And the weird part is they're trying to make markets in stocks where the bank owned like 70% of the stock. And I'm going, wait a minute. What kind of a free market is that? And they didn't know what I was talking about. It was, but you'd talk to them and they'd say, you know, if you're an attorney over here, you have to work for a law firm and only the big guys make the dough. Nobody becomes a partner till they're like 50. There's no way you can start another law firm because no judge would give you the delight. You can't be an independent attorney. Same way you couldn't be an independent options trader. I don't see how you could, because everybody was an options trader, sat in a bank. And you know, it's and they would say, I can't, I'm never going to be good at anything until I'm never going to make any money until I'm 45 or 50. The thought of any one of those breaking away and becoming their own options spot, like you can sort of still do here if you wanted to, the thought of becoming your own brokerage firm, which is now harder and harder to do here, I mean, it would never even cross their mind. And I just thought that world really sucked, for lack of a better term. Because and now I talk to young people here, and they sound the same way. I mean, I guess I'm kind of pleading with you guys because you have a much better input into that generation. Do they? We're not there yet. Let's put it that way. I agree with you guys. We're not there yet. You can be your own attorney. You can be this, that, and the other thing. But I mean, look at the difference between what an attorney here makes that actually represents regular people versus an attorney that goes into a big firm and does, one firm taking over another work. One guy's making $100 an hour, the other guy's making $1,000, right?
Yeah, it's basically Better Call Saul versus the guy that just bought the $500,000 Porsche that lives down the street from me.
Yeah.
So.
Doctor, your class has a lot of entrepreneurial stuff in there, right? What do you think the attitude is?
There's a lot of there's a lot of entrepreneurial spirit and folks that are looking at different things that want they reach out to me again around private equity, which I think they think I know about because I'm involved in the markets, but I'm really not. I don't know any more about private equity than most academics, but they also want to learn more about systematic trading, etc. That's they don't really reach out to me with a basic business idea and want to try to develop that just because I'm in the finance area.
You guys got to give me a one market call. We got money supply creeping up faster than maybe we would like. We've got stuff going around the world. We've got Bitcoin for some reason dropping a little bit lately, although not precipitously. Gold is absolutely on a tear. Should I be getting out or should I be buying more? I have no idea.
Gold has me freaking perplexed.
Me too. That's why I'm asking you. You're
the
professor.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are some entities that have been pushing the price of gold up outside of the U.S., and they're doing so because they don't think the geopolitical situation is going to get much better.
Doctor, what do you think?
I know China's been selling our bonds and loading up on gold. India is always a big consumer of gold. I don't know how much that's a bet on. Things continuing to deteriorate around the world, and I don't know if we're going to end up in a shooting war with one of our big rivals or not. But I feel like that's what you got to believe if you think that gold's going to have much of a leg from here.
Well, what if Trump does get the Federal Reserve to totally co-opt and pours enough money in to drop the rate to 1%? Where does that send gold?
He's not going to be able to do that. We're a major one of the great things about our government, our system, is it's really sloppy and it's set up in a way that, to a certain point, people can do things with executive orders, but then the legal part, the legislative part, will get involved and offset what the executive's trying to do. And he's starting to see so much pushback. I don't think he's going to be able to get anything done that he wants to get done, even tariffs.
Well, yeah, there's a
possibility we're going to have to pay those things back. I mean, this is,
do you guys think we're seeing
why other leaders have not, been as dramatic, because they've just known that everything was going to get reversed on them.
Do you guys think they're actually going to write the checks back to people?
Who knows? Maybe they'll give them a credit.
Doctor, I got a gold story for you, if you got a second. By the way, loved having you again.
Listen to your gold story.
Lou lives, he's got his, I won't call it a summer house, but he's got a house up in the mountains in Colorado, and I think it's near Cripple Creek, which, for those that don't know, a significant percentage of all the gold in this country that was ever mined here was mined there. and they've got these massive amounts of what's the stuff that you get when you're done with gold, the little hunks of steel that are they're horrible, they're dusty, and you got to spray them in the summertime and everything. They're called there's a name for it, essentially the spillover crap. And these guys have been mining those things, and they found out that there's enough gold left that they get out better now with the new processes. And these guys make, well, I think he told me, $10 million a month or some number. Well, evidently
they're fracking gold out of something.
No, they're taking.
That really sounds like, it sounds like that's kind of what they're doing.
Well,
it's like they didn't think they could get to a certain oil, and then they created a process.
No, this is all above ground.
It's above ground. I know, but so they're pulling the gold out of something they didn't think they could pull it out of.
Out of what used to be the waste.
Yeah.
But so
that's kind of the same as frack. I mean, it's a different process.
But evidently, there's still mines around there. There's mines around there, and they think there's a big new vein, and they think the vein is under the town.
Oh,
so the company has offered to buy the town and relocate everybody, so they can mine under the town. And so far, the town's not having any of it. But Luke goes, yeah, these guys want to. You know, it's not like there's a million people there or anything, but because they want to. Buy and relocate the town because they think the underneath the town is where the new vein is. How wild is that?
That's that tells you that and I'm sure there's going to be one grumpy old guy.
Yeah,
that's not going to sell.
Well, I mean, you would think you'd. Now, would you want a piece of the mining company before you sold? I might.
I would. I would be very patient with myself. I would not be the first seller.
No, I mean, it's got to be all or none.
It's not a case of the first sell is the best sell.
How would that even work? It's got to be a case of all or none, right?
You would think everybody's got to buy in, or yeah, you would think.
Doctor, I hope to make you a regular. You're a breath of fresh air.
Oh, thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I thoroughly enjoy the conversation. With the both of you.
By the way, so have you your classes Wednesday. All start? When do you guys start?
I'm in week two.
Okay.
I think Russell's in week three.
Because Madison just started yesterday, right? They're not all on the same day.
No.
There are a couple. I think Madison, like Northwestern, starts a little late too. So there are a couple schools that start after Labor Day.
How are your teams doing? The Irish lost week one.
We both won.
What are you
doing? Indiana won, but
good for you. The Irish are playing Purdue. Mm-hmm. Next time we're on, we'll talk a little bit about what do you think the difference is between football budget at Ohio State versus Purdue. 10-1.
A lot.
I think so.
Oh God! Well, next time, you guys have a great week. Talk at you next week. SP Futures, they haven't moved. That's why we didn't do any of the breaks. We're still up 22. We're up 22 when we started. We're still up 22. NASDAQ Futures up 157. We're actually a little higher, Russell, I think, than when we started yesterday morning. So the big sell-off to come back, and now we're probably even on the week, which is, you wouldn't have guessed that about 10 o'clock yesterday. But that's where we are. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
That's all, folks.